This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Education, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Christina Bosch, the host of the channel today, and I have two guests with me who are going to introduce themselves and say their own names so that I don't butcher it. First, we have Hanna
Bertilsdotter Rosqvist.
Thank you. And Anna.
Anna Stenning.
Who, along with Nick Chown, are the editors of the new book, Neurodiversity Studies, A New Critical Paradigm, first published in 2020 by Routledge in their Advances in Sociology series. This book should be cross-listed with that channel as well, but education seems very appropriate for the interdisciplinary nature of the book, as well as the scholarship that Anna and Hannah are going to share about today. Anna is the Wellcome Research Fellow in the Humanities and Social Sciences in the School of English at the University of Leeds. And Hannah is an Associate Professor in Sociology and a Senior Lecturer in Social Work at
Södertörns Högskola or Södertörns University.
In Stockholm, Sweden. Thank you so much for chiming in at the exact right moment right there. Anna and Hannah, welcome to the show and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, so just to begin, it would be lovely to hear each of you introduce yourselves, share as much of your bio and background as you wish, and maybe how you met or began working together. Hannah, would you like to go first?
I did my PhD on bisexuality, so I'm coming from queer studies, and I wasn't really into autism in some way. I was into normativity. So I was coming into autism studies 2009. With the aim to do some kind of critical work on neurotypicality. But I got stuck up in a way and started to try to learn anything about autism or perhaps autistic subjectivities. And during my first field work, during that 2009 field work, I was peer diagnosed by the people I was kind of researching. So they said to me, I'm autistic myself, and I was kind of a bit, it was a strange suggestion for me then. But I started to identify, I think around 2016, but I haven't really been open until this, the work with the book, because I suddenly felt it was a political thing to be more open, but also I realized like the challenge is to be open when you are a senior researcher, and also those expectations of what it is to be an autistic researcher is still kind of very fragile, as it's still a very new position. So I think the book is also part of kind of formulating a new autism researcher self. So
thank you. Thank you for that. Anna, would you like to share a bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, I'm a postdoctoral fellow. So I'm working on a 3-year research project. And the project is about life writing by identified autistic authors, either self-identifying or diagnosed. And I'm interested in what these accounts tell us about autism isn't known kind of in widespread, in sort of more broad cultural narratives about autism, and also how writing a book can help to create agency for the author around their own understanding of their lives. And I myself came to this field from a background in environmental literary criticism, which was what my PhD was on. So obviously my background is quite different to Hannah's. I first came across a particular book which was called Fingers in the Sparkle Jar by Chris Packham, and he's a well-known British nature broadcaster, and it was the first time that he kind of publicly talked about what his autism or neuroatypical life meant to him, and particularly how it allowed for particular kinds of joy and pleasure in the natural world. So I was thinking about that led to this project, and then I joined a community of online openly autistic researchers, which I wasn't expecting to find, and that's where I met Hannah and Nick. And say that it was Hannah and Nick who first came up with the idea for the book, and I was sort of invited on as a kind of co-traveller, so I'm very grateful to them for that. And we were working on neurodiversity as a much broader idea than what was being done in critical autism studies, and we were working within a kind of broadly social model of autism and other kinds of disability.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that background. I want to pick up on something that you just mentioned, Anna. We're going to sort of start off this interview by trying to explain some of the key terms and concepts for people listening in before we get into an overview of the book's content. And you just mentioned critical autism studies. And there are some moments in the book where you also refer to critical autism studies sort of being the central or centered area of focus right now in the UK. I was wondering if you could just say a few words about the difference between, and we haven't even defined neurodiversity, so maybe we will in doing this, but yeah, critical autism studies, neurodiversity studies, how can we maybe compare and contrast? And I guess I'll start out with Anna, since you mentioned it in your last thing, and then I'll shift to Hannah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm newer to the to this field than Hannah, so I'll have a go.
And okay.
critical autism studies is something that has come out of probably mainly sort of UK and European scholars who are working within sociology and looking at finding a kind of non-pathologizing or more kind of encompassing ideas about what autism might mean, particularly within the course of an individual life. So the critical would refer to the kind of engaging with existing medical accounts and seeing how they would maybe be unable to account for certain experiences or actually cause potential harms for people who are labelled as such. It is very much focused on autism because I think there's perhaps been more of an autism. It comes out of autistic self-advocacy and kind of social and activist movements that haven't necessarily occurred yet so much for other neurodivergent identities, certainly not within the UK. So I think that is starting to happen now here. I think there are definitely more recognition for the need to theorize what other kind of neuro-minority experiences might be like, building on the fact that some of us are able to be out and kind of open in a way that isn't necessarily possible for other kinds of neuro-minority. So I think that's where it comes from. Is there anything else I missed, Hannah? Do you
think? I think that because I was coming into this field in 2009, and I didn't know much about it then, but now I kind of start to realize that it has a critical agenda. But most researchers within that field is still neurotypical. And it makes difference when you do research as a neurotypical researcher is kind of inviting autistic people to be on board in the research process. But what is about neurodiverse studies is mostly that it's autistic-led or neurodivergent-led. That makes it, if I compare to the queer studies, it's a similar step. At first, you have sexology, which was kind of done by the heterosexual sexologists people, who was looking at non-heterosexuals. And now it's a similar turn in autism studies. And maybe the first steps on critical autism studies was a very important step. So we really wanted to kind of do something not pathologizing, but it was still within the frame of thinking about autism as the other, the cognitive other. So what we are trying to do is to marginalize the center, and that is to kind of put in the kind of autistic view on world to be the center, not the, the non-autistic view on world, or the non-divergent view on world.
Yeah. So that's, thank you so much for connecting that also to the history of queer theory the way that critical research on autism has been led by neurotypical people is also like a very important thing to mention, and I think to begin to orient listeners. So I guess let's pick up on that. We've already referenced neurotypicality, which will often be abbreviated in conversation as NT. And we've also mentioned autism, and we've also mentioned neurodiversity. So let's introduce that central term, neurodiversity. Again, the book is called Neurodiversity Studies: A New Critical Paradigm. So in the introduction, right, you all write, quote, "The concept of neurodiversity usually refers to perceived variations seen in cognitive, affectual, and sensory functioning, differing from the majority of the general population, or in quotes, the predominant neurotype, more usually known as the neurotypical population. The ontological assumption of neurodiversity is often contrasted with the ideological position that there is a recurrent normal cognitive, affective, and sensory type, otherwise known as the normal human being or the, quote, normate." Yes, a term I had never heard before. The Garland Thompson, 1997, is quoted right there. And I think this is really important. Again, or the normate as defined in the first half of the 20th century by psychologists who were living in the shadow of eugenics. So there's a lot in there. And I'm about to suggest that in order to center the concept of neurodiversity on this show, and Hannah, you alluded to that, I am going to suggest that paradoxically, perhaps, we begin by contouring the other side of that neurotypicality, because despite its roots in a discredited yet enduring field like eugenics, this remains indiscernible, taken for granted in so many discourses. Can you talk a little bit about the I think this is another issue too in inclusive education, right? In issues related to disability and ability, we have these binaries, and often the typical, right, or the more mainstream or centered privileged identity is actually way less defined than the alternate, or what it's put in contrast to. I know it's incredibly challenging to define terms, and I'm not trying to get overly into semantics, but I would just be really interested in any thoughts you have or talking about whether it's useful to even begin actually by turning the gaze back on the neurotypical and talking about what that even means, or if we're just recentering neurotypicality by doing that.
I think it's similar to the Garland Thompson project. So she's trying to, at least from the disability studies field perspective, to think about non-disabled body and what is that doing? So I think it's a similar project to kind of try to, from the perspective of the neurodivergent person, to look at the non-divergent, so that's, for me, it's easy to use normate, because it's an kind of not universal, but it's kind of, normate is always constructed in relationship to the borders and the others, and it's also situated in a specific kind of context. So what is a normate, a cognitive normate in Sweden, is not the same thing as in Britain or in USA.
Right. It's always shifting.
Yeah.
Okay. So this normate term is a term from disability studies, and it is helpful for us because it helps us understand. Wonderful. Okay. Sorry. Anna, would you like to add anything?
I was going to say, you know, if you wanted a very kind of basic definition to guide the readers into the more complex, you know, sort of iterations of the idea. I think you could say that neurotypical, which is often abbreviated NT, means having a style of neurocognitive functioning that falls within what society determines is normal. So it would be, obviously, again, it would be relative to the society, the time frame, because we think particular forms of neurodivergence have emerged within the 20th century. They wouldn't have made any sense before then, particularly diagnostic categories, but also even the idea of that there was a desirable normality wouldn't necessarily have been seen in the same way. So hopefully that helps a little bit.
That's right. No, yeah, that's a huge help. And I also think that my first reaction is it's so helpful to have terms that throw the context, the temporal context, the social context, the geopolitical context into relief so that we can see it, because so often these things are just assumed and absorbed into normate perspectives and narratives, and there are pieces that we know really exist and can be called out and recognized if we just, I think, get some of the right terms and perspectives under our belts. So that was also super helpful for just, yeah, putting that those definitions sort of right up front, Anna. Thank you. I want to go back for a second to, again, this idea of centering the margins, right, or decentering what is normally centered, which, as you mentioned in the book, owes a great debt to Black feminism, queer theory. And you begin in the introduction by immediately establishing that, quote, the myths of the ideal rational person and the supposed universality of propositions about human nature have been oppressive to those who are not European, white, male, middle class, Christian, able-bodied, thin, and heterosexual. And that's thanks to a seminal article by Ellsworth in 1989, where she talks about the critical pedagogy's challenges or limitations in actually decentering those privileged identities, right? So also just right off the bat, that's an important assumption for people to understand too. And if you're not with us on that, let's talk later or something. You need to do back in later, because this is an incredibly important starting point. And then you all extend this assumption to the topic of neurodiversity by saying, the construct of the neurotypical as an ideal ethical subject may be added to the list of assumptions about ideal rationality, since rationality is often conceived in terms of cognitive, social, and sensory behaviors in psychology. Through describing behaviors from the outside and through medical, economic, and social interventions, subjects are being produced as deviants to assumed standards of intellectual, perceptual, and emotional processing. They become subjects to both internal and external oppression. So I thought here I would also just bring in the word critical from the title, right? A new critical paradigm, neurodiversity studies. Can you talk a bit about the choice of that particular word, critical, and maybe even paradigm?
Yeah, I think it's back to the critical autist studies. There was a long discussion scene, I think, since about 2016, mostly in the British context, about what is critical in critical autism studies, that they felt, at least some autistic researchers felt that they were still left behind, left out. So that is one thing that is really critical in terms of critical towards and neurotypical, and what is not kind of some kind of neurodivergent experience. Not really the subjectivity, but the power structure. And the things which is kind of taken for granted, because you always think about the human as a cognitive normate, actually, which is where everybody else is kind of less human. And I think also when it comes to critical, it's also about, we can't just say that we are critical. We also have to form new tools for doing critical work. And I think a lot of what is being done in the book is to try to check or to try to develop, to try on different kinds of research tools, which hasn't been used before. Okay, we talk about action research, participatory research within critical autism studies, but really to do it in a kind of from the neurodivergent perspective, or for to in a way which kind of support neurodivergent people to participate and to do research themselves. If we are going to do that, we need new methods. So that's also part of the critical.
Amazing. Excellent. Thank you. Anna, do you have anything to add on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, perhaps to also address the idea of the paradigm that we're looking at. I mean, obviously, the existing paradigm for autism research is the medical model based on the idea of disorders, particular kinds of disorder that are replicable among different subjects according to these kind of narrow, perhaps, or certainly universalizable models. So that was the medical paradigm is one. And then I guess critical autism studies is moving to looking at the idea that there might be particular differences in how we experience the world, which were also, again, perhaps equally defined, or that they might be established and advanced, whereas neurodiversity would seek to say that, well, how could these things ever be known within the kind of existing ways of producing knowledge, where we don't seek ideas and kind of interactions with neurodivergent people. We're just sort of imposing our pre-existing ideas on them. But also, as a paradigm, it's more of a kind of ontological position rather than an activist or necessarily a particular ethical stance. We're looking at it as a way of producing knowledge with a kind of more, say, humanizing agenda than one that just seeks to find sort of isolated parts of disordered brains that can be separated from the context that we've been talking about, the lives that people live, the challenges they find from living in a society that is increasingly kind of homogenous, perhaps, for different kinds of people.
Thank you so much for that expanded explanation and for bringing up, I think we've alluded to it maybe a couple of times now, but the medical model of disability, right, which stands in contrast to the social model of disability, which is also being challenged, expanded on in new ways, thanks to some of the contributions in your book. I know that in Latin America, there's also a framework, functional diversity, that's gaining traction. And I'm not sure what else. I'm sure there are many more things out there that I'm not aware of. But yeah, just to sort of briefly name those, and people can look those up if those are terms and paradigms that they're not familiar with. I want to also just take the opportunity to touch on an important piece where I also think your book really resonates with a lot of conversations that are becoming more popular, accessible in at least discourses that I'm able to plug into here in the U.S. This is the idea of diversity not being a trait that is possessed by an individual, but rather a group. And so, you know, you specifically mentioned at one point also in the intro that Nick Walker says, quote, diversity is a trait possessed by a group, not an individual. And to talk of individuals as neurodiverse is to situate them as other to the norm, as well as being, in our opinion, nonsensical. Again, I'm quoting from you. So just to be clear also with listeners, yeah, like any one individual is going to be part of a group that may be described as neurotypical, or a group that may be described as neurodivergent or neurodiverse, right? Is there a difference between those last two terms?
Yes.
Okay.
And that is also part of why it's so happened so fast right now. So since 2 or 3 years, there's a lot of things has been changed. That when we started to do this book, there was, in some places, it was completely right to talk about neurodiverse or neurodiverse people. But now it's more feel if it is better to talk about neurodivergent people, that everybody is actually neurodiverse because everybody has different kinds of brains. But that's also a problem, that when you talk about neurodiversity, people try to think about, some people try to translate that into atypicality. So that's the problem now with the term, that neurodiversity is not about atypicality. Neurodiversity is about the human brain is different. All kinds of brains are different. But then we have a power situation, power structure situation, where there are some people who is defined as other. And those are the neurodivergent people, which is not only about autistic people, but also about the rest of it, the groups who has been excluded from the kind of cognitive norms in different kinds of ways, which could be ADHD, dementia, as a lot of kinds of groups.
Got you. That's super helpful. Yes, I imagine also that with the way things change and take off, and then writing a book, it takes so much, they run at different speeds, the publishing world and maybe that popular culture. Okay, so that's super helpful. Anna, do you have any thoughts on this distinction, neurodivergent, neurodiverse?
I mean, I guess maybe this, just to make it even more confusing, perhaps, if a group of people share a same kind of identity, you could say that they form a neuro-minority.
Right.
Just to kind of
thank you.
Maybe help to bring a little bit of order on that idea.
Thank you so much. And I think, you know, there's another term that you all use at one point. I think it's in the conclusion, but you talk about cognitive decolonization or cognitive decolonialization. And I think that's part of what's happening here, right? So we're doing it because, I mean, I don't, would you, either of you like to say a bit more about what that means rather than me try to do it?
I can try. It's a matter of being also, I don't know, humbled that you kind of know that a lot of research questions has been kind of asked to autistic people and their families has repeating certain paradigm, which are kind of colonizer's gaze. It's an outsider's gaze on certain experiences. And in order to kind of get out of that gaze, you need to look back and you need to decolonize that gaze. Like the kind of white British person is coming into the Africa and do some things with them. It needs to get out from the mindset.
Right. There's so many levels and structures that we're enmeshed in that are part of that legacy. And just to segue, I want to talk now, just, you know, go quickly through the book's content, but I do want to just mention like that there is a kind of urgency, I think, around this book. Decolonization, I think, is always a pretty urgent matter. But I also, you know, just really appreciate the way that you all write, actually, that new theoretical perspectives in neurodiversity studies are needed, quote, before the urge to render humanity free of deficits becomes an imperative to reduce society of the burden of disability, in this case, in the form of neurodiversity, before its full implications are understood. I just thought that was an incredibly powerful sentence, and I'm sure there are some things in there you may want to unpack, like the burden of disability. I'm sure is, you know, a term that you're using to describe the way society approaches disability, right? And as we see things like technology, adaptive technology, implant technology advancing at really rapid paces, I'm just super curious to hear any kind of thoughts you have on the urgency behind getting this work out into the public, and the urgency behind the need for neurodiversity studies and theorizing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to have a go. I mean, please feel free to add to this, Hannah. I mean, I think Nick talks a bit in his chapter for the book, Nick Chown, that is, about the way that the idea that autism is either something that needs to be cured or eradicated has become such a kind of, it's unquestioned assumption in all kind of interactions with autism that it doesn't seem to, it's never questioned. And I think even if, you know, medical research is conducted with the aim of producing good outcomes, it doesn't have any room for the idea that it affects real people. But for instance, during the COVID pandemic in the UK, we know that autistic people were much less likely to be, you know, resuscitated if they were in hospital for, you know, for pneumonia resulting from COVID. There's a kind of tacit assumption that it would be much better to try and give the equipment to someone who wasn't labelled autistic or otherwise disabled. It's a kind of, it seems to be the kind of narrative story that is unquestioned, and it's so problematic in so many different areas. I mean, that's just one kind of small area. And it, Virginia Bovell talks about the ethics of research into prenatal testing, particularly again with reference to autism, and how the different kind of the questions that have been asked don't really have any kind of consideration for the kind of deeper ethical issues that emerge. And that chapter is just really well argued and articulated about the kind of deeper ethical debates that need to emerge about what it means to be human, what it means to be part of a society, which I think, given that the same stories have been told over and over again, which is, I think, something we say in the introduction, how can anything change? We need a kind of radical new paradigm to produce new kinds of knowledge.
Thank you. And thank you so much for connecting that this issue to the pandemic that we're still, that we're living through, that we're still in. Hanna, do you have anything to add on this?
No, I think it's also about the gender issue. Like in Sweden, we do put our small children into kindergarten, which is kind of strict teaching into certain social behaviors, which then led into the elementary school and further on into universities. So there's a whole process of forming some certain subjects. And I think it's Mitzi Watz in the book who's talking about the kind of producing of certain kind of workers since the kind of the modern or the Western modern time. So it's not just about autism. It's about the whole world's capacity to have kind of different kinds of humans and the difficulties with people who can't be put into that kind of strict teaching or strict education into certain subjects.
Yeah, I mean, just as someone in education, we've just touched on, you know, very common issues in the charterization of education, for example, or reproductive and birthing people's relationship to child rearing and schooling. I mean, there's so many connections in the book to just, it's incredibly intersectional in terms of the other issues that are relevant that it raises. So yeah, let's just go through the content now, you know, quickly. I know that we're probably coming up on the end of the time. But I wanted to just sort of go through, there's five main sections that you chose to organize the book into. The first is curing neurodivergence / eugenics. We've just discussed this a bit. This section touches on cognitive othering to produce autism as a category and neurodivergent subjects, the psychological measures of normalcy that were produced after World War I regarding citizenry and productivity. Real interesting intersection there, I thought, also with like economics, neurotypical language games, and the ethics of cure and prevention. So that's a lot of stuff. Any way to sort of summarize or raise up even maybe one of your favorite points or something from that section of the book? I guess I'll start with you, Hanna, since you are smiling at me.
Yeah, I think actually it is, I mean, it's a World Cup chapter. It's about to understand that the autism thing is not about autism. It's about productions of childhood and what kind of subjects we want to kind of become, a certain kind of citizenship, which is very closely connected to a certain idea of what is the good citizen in the particular kind of world.
Right.
So I think for me, at least, I know there is a critical psychological work. So Mitzi Watz is not the only one who's kind of into this and how to kind of to understand if you're producing a certain childhood and what is the kind of what pathological childhoods is being produced in the same time as you're kind of producing the ideal or some kind of that kind of childhood.
Okay, and so then we can just shift to the second section, which is about also, you know, you just mentioned this, Hannah, supporting the shift from neurodivergent pathologizing to neurodivergent well-being, which is a theme that organizes the second cluster of chapters and is a theme that I think has become also just very, the well-being industry is increasingly prominent. So it just, yeah, like I can just imagine that there's so much interesting stuff to say in this section. And maybe Anna, I'll ask you for any thoughts or summaries on this piece. But go ahead. Yeah, please.
I mean, yeah, quite much rich. Obviously, I would encourage listeners to read the book and
yes,
to engage with it. But I think an important point about the reason we structured the book this way is that
yeah,
we weren't trying to say often there's a stereotype that neurodiversity, or those that are kind of interested in neurodiversity, reject the idea that there might be any difficulties that are experienced by those who've been labeled as autistic or ADHD. When obviously this isn't the case. Certainly in the case of, there are often, you know, people look at these things differently within the same idea that there is a natural underlying kind of cognitive difference amongst people. And this chapter kind of goes into more into where difficulties may emerge, which are more to do with being a kind of neural atypical in a normative, highly regulated society, and what kinds of why the pathology perspective doesn't allow room for the kind of becoming, collective becoming and understanding of different forms of life that we gain through understanding neurodiversity. So obviously well-being can be a very kind of marketized idea. I think the chapter does go way beyond that. I hope
yes,
it does. It was meant to be a kind of more, in a sense that it's an accessible term that doesn't
yeah,
carry with it too much of a kind of, I mean, that particular section does talk about kind of ethical ideas about what a good life is as well. But we wanted to think about, encourage the reader to just sort of approach it with their own, you know, without any kind of any prior ideas about what neurodivergent well-being might be, which obviously will depend on particular context.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for that. Sorry for the interruption on my end. I don't know if you heard that, but okay, great. Do you have anything that you would like to add to that piece, Hannah?
No.
Okay.
I just want to say that this is quite hard, actually, to try to kind of actually try to sum the chapters.
It's
because
very hard. Because it's incredibly, I mean, it's a groundbreaking book. It's incredibly rich. It's incredibly intersectional, meaning it really intersects with so many other topics, disciplines, et cetera. So yes, thank you for recognizing that and still trying to do it with me, because I really wanted the chance to kind of go through it. And yes, the listeners will hopefully also be readers because there's just so much in here. Getting into the third section, yeah, and this is where also, Anna, you have a chapter that you authored, Understanding Empathy Through a Study of Autistic Life Writing on the Importance of Neurodivergent Morality. This section is on cross-neurotype communication, which I really appreciated and which we're doing right now, hopefully. Here we get into cross-cultural communication principles applied to cross-neurotype communication, and also some. There was a chapter in this section that started out with kind of like a poem, and I thought it was just a really nice example of like almost a living example of what that looks like and means. We also have in here the ethical implications of neurodiversity and neurodivergent morality, and another chapter too on collective knowledge production, I guess is how I would summarize it. Any way to sort of orient us to highlights here? And maybe I'll throw this back to Anna, since you have a chapter in here, and it's maybe easy for you to just sort of say a couple words about it.
Yeah, I mean, I'd also mention Hannah's a co-author of one of the chapters. She did a lot of work in this book. It's easy to, I mean, that was, what's really interesting is that, yeah, that chapter, it is an example of working across, you know, multiple neuroscience. But I think for me, obviously my work is about English language and how, in fact, understanding neurodiversity could help us see communication differently, as in, I guess that's really what all of my work's about. What might be overlooked when we look at a text if we don't think about different kinds of communicator and the way that their stories might be hidden by dominant narratives about what it is to be human. So I talk particularly about, in that chapter, about the kind of the rise in quite prominent, outspoken, autistic commentators on different aspects of society, including Greta Thunberg and Chris Backham in the UK, who have been attacked because of their neurodivergence. And actually looking at how that kind of fits with some of the psychological constructions of autism, which have kind of seen autistic behaviour as kind of either deficient in any kind of morality or as being directly resulting from the neurology rather than as a kind of complex engagement with the world, which I think is particularly hard for Greta Thunberg, because obviously there's the intersectionality of that with the fact that she's a young woman. Right. You can see how these different social markers of identity are used to silence people. But actually what most people, or what a lot of people recognise, is that people whose life experiences are kind of quite different as a result of being outside of dominant cultural ideas, they have a lot to bring to the kind of the key issues that we all face. And it's not about having neurodivergence as a superpower. It's about valuing different kinds of knowledge and experience. So I was quite pleased to talk about, hopefully that particular chapter has an appeal to people who don't necessarily have knowledge of the kind of history of critical autism studies, because it focuses more on quite well-known individual people.
Thank you so much for calling that out. And yeah, I'm actually going to now, to just get into the fourth section, I'm going to kick it back to Hannah, because this section, well, of course, as you mentioned, Anna, there's, you know, you both, and along with Nick as editors of the book, are in everything. And I know also that Hannah, you've written about autistic workspaces, and this fourth section is about neurodiversity at work. I'm just also curious how that section has held up or contributed, if at all, to understanding the massive shift in how people have been working within academic institutions, for example, during COVID-19. But anything that you really want to say, I mean, there's three chapters within this section, neurodiversity at work. So it just seems also like it came out at the right time, because there's been such a sea change in how we do things. So any thoughts on that, Hannah?
I think it's two things. First, that in the first chapter in that section, where I think Nicola Martin is trying to start out some way to formulate a neurotypical research position, which is actually kind of ethical in relationship to the critical autism studies researchers, which has been informed and want to do ethical work, but perhaps haven't been self-critical enough. And she's really trying to kind of deconstruct a certain position as a researcher, what to do as a neurotypical researcher in some kind of neurodiversity studies, because that position is quite ambivalent. What is actually the place for neurotypical researchers? And I think actually that chapter is a beginning of something. So she's kind of starting to map out possibilities for a neurotypical researcher in neurodiverse studies. And in the chapter 10, where I, together with a group of autistic researchers and activists in Sweden and also a German researcher, we are trying to kind of think what is the meaning to work as an autistic research group in autistic writing space. And we really developed the feeling that it's not just to say that, okay, I can write a narrative about myself. Because if you keep on working with your story, your narrative in your kind of own space, you will keep on actually repeating the big stories, which is repeatedly said. So we had to make new space in order to be able to narrate new stories. And I think that was also the same thing with my other chapter, the sensory strangers, that it's all about the space. That we have to redefine the research space in order to make new stories, basically.
Thank you. That's so important. Also, as a segue, I think I'm going to just sort of lump in the fifth part with the sixth part, because both of these have to do with the future and the new stories and sort of like what's coming, hopefully as a result of this kind of work. So the fifth section is challenging brain-bound cognition. And you all write that hopefully this marks the way forward for a future neurodiversity studies that's able to loop between the different domains in which the term is used, rather than contribute to the othering that has produced the marginalization of neurodivergent people. Just, is there any way to give us a little teaser on, I'm sure for a lot of folks, challenging brain-bound cognition is like, makes their brain-bound cognition explode. So yeah, is there any way to give us a quick teaser on that and how you see this work maybe occurring into the present and the future, since this book came out in 2020? I mean, it's only a year ago, but since this has to do with future directions and whatnot, any comments on that? Yeah.
A few kind of brief comments. I do also think it is worth saying that the situation of the lockdown has maybe produced new opportunities for collaborations and writing partnerships to happen, particularly for neurodivergent people who struggle with traveling to different places and for whom there are particular kind of constraints on the resources to allocate to academic knowledge production. Obviously, right. One of the kind of possibly few good things that come out of this situation. I do think one of the things that really surprises me about research on neurodivergent conditions within the kind of medical model approach is that the newer ideas from cognitive science, such as the idea of inactive study of the mind, which sees that what we think of as our mental life is produced through interaction with particular environments and other people. It's not located within a kind of a Cartesian mind outside in a transcendental realm. And yet still, particularly within construction of all of conditions that are included in diagnostic manuals, including developmental disorders, the conditions they're described without any reference to the context or the environment, and which obviously, within the neurodiversity paradigm, is what produced some of the difficulties that are described as autism or ADHD. So it's, why is it that we still have a very kind of behaviorist model of autism when there are different ways of doing even psychological science within a kind of neoliberal paradigm? It just seems so bizarre. So that I think we all share, Nick especially is interested in those, the cognitive science, what it might tell us about neurodiversity. I think also intersectionality, you've mentioned a lot. I think we need to think through a lot more about how particular social identities might combine to make particular challenges for neurodivergent people in particular, challenges in receiving the right support, I think that and then the need to go beyond the kind of autistic dominated research that this book is still predominantly autistic led. A truly kind of neurodivergent space would have much greater representation. We wouldn't also all be white. We would not be within the kind of the minority world. It's just a very small beginning, I think, that raises some very big issues that we hope other people will add to and think through.
Hannah?
Oh, I start to get too tired, but I think, at least for me, it's very much about saying aloud that we can't go on with the anti-business as user. And like the queer studies, it can't go on because you can't go further with the research which can keep repeating certain questions and getting the same answers again because it doesn't work. So we are trying to map out actually new ways further, both for social work and for education, that we need to develop new strategies for teaching and new strategies for support, which actually is based more on neurodivergent experiences, not non-neurodivergent expectations of neurodivergent experiences. So that kind of idea is quite basic.
Well, I think that this book goes a long way towards accomplishing that, and I appreciate so much your closing comments on the representation in here as well, Anna. I think, as we've alluded to, within neurodiversity or neurodivergent groups, there's much more than just autism, right? And well, as we said in the beginning, everyone is neurodiverse. There's a lot of, I think, room to grow. And I thank you both so much for putting this out there as a way for people to get started and for people like me to access these concepts. I guess just to wrap up, would you like to share briefly whatever you're working on these days or what is holding your interest at this moment in time? I'll start out with Hannah.
Actually, me and Hannah, together with three other people, who's working together on narrative agency. As I'm not the only one, but we kind of it's not my concept or Anna's concept, but kind of Anna brought it into this group, this concept. So I think that is quite important to think about. Really, what does it mean to have a narrative agency? If you don't have it, what can you actually say? And that also connected to another project of mine, which is about cross neurotype translation. So building further from the communication thing, it's also about translation. So in order to be able to translate, you have to be aware of and recognize the different narrative agencies and abilities to narrate yourself. But then you also start to need, you need to start learning translate between the cultures.
Fascinating. Thank you. Anna?
Yeah, as well as the project, Hannah mentioned, I'm also working on a panel, a group panel presentation for the ASLE conference, which is a study of literature in the environment, which is really exciting for me because it means I get to bring together my interest in kind of disability studies and environmental writing. But really exciting, I'm going to be working with a very kind of diverse representation of autistic people who are interested in the environment, and kind of working with the environment to make poetry, life writing, and also fine visual arts. So that's something that's coming up soon. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Fascinating projects. I'm sure that we'll be keeping in touch, or I'll at least be following you and seeing what y'all are up to. So thank you again so much for talking with us today and being so generous with your time. I just really appreciate it and really enjoyed it. So thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.